Good afternoon. Before we begin, a brief announcement. I had the wrong times on this appointment list in the back, so those that are expecting an appointment in 5 minutes, you're not going to get it. So it's been adjusted. So, I mean, you all in the same order, it's just we're starting later. And is my voice carrying to the back? Okay, good. So more questions this afternoon. Now this morning when I was talking about consciousness and one and saying I don't really like the adjectives to define consciousness because there is just this one consciousness, doesn't mean that I don't use them, and Joel uses them a lot. So somebody's pointed out that in the book that Joel talks about individual consciousness as the cause, law, and power of being. Well, that's the one consciousness, since there is only one consciousness. And I looked in my book to find where that is, but I think I have a different version because I couldn't find that on the page that was referred to. So, but Joel uses Christ consciousness. Joel uses individual consciousness. He uses God consciousness. That it really is not, there's no hard and fast rule other than the idea that there is no separation between any of these. They are the same. That's the whole idea of consciousness, of using that, because it unites us into this idea of oneness, where when we use God, sometimes that comes with other baggage. If we use just Christ or Jesus was the man. So when you're praying to Jesus, if that was something that was part of your tradition, that's praying to the person who exemplarized and demonstrated Christ consciousness. You know, the Trinity is a very interesting idea because, and I grew up in a religion that didn't have the Trinity, and this is something that I learned about later on, is the idea of three in one. And I remember when I first heard this and people were talking about it, all I could think of, and it still pops into my mind today when I say that, is a little can of 3-in-1 oil. And maybe that's a good, something to hang on to. I mean, it's very multi-purpose, that it serves all these functions, but it's still an oil. The consciousness is still consciousness, no matter if it is appearing as God the Father, God the Son, or God the Holy Spirit. It's all one consciousness, whether it is appearing as the soul, the mind, or the body. That's individual consciousness. You cannot separate soul, mind, and body from Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They are one. But they appear in form. Now, the essence of our study this week is God, the substance of all form. God, this spiritual consciousness, appears as. Now that, yeah, I mean, you can repeat that 1,000 times in your mind, but when you experience that, when you have an experience of oneness, where you realize that the I of you is the I of God, the I of God, that one consciousness manifests as all creation, then you are one with all creation. That is a deep spiritual experience, and it moves you to a place in your spiritual evolution, evolution of spiritual awareness, to that point where you look at this world with a different perspective. You do not see this world fearfully. You do not see this world filled with danger, filled with power that maybe can harm, or power that could benefit. What you see is that all life is this manifestation God appearing as. So there is only one. So when Joel uses individual consciousness, or Joel uses Christ consciousness, he's talking about that one essence, that one spiritual truth that comes into human experience. And it takes an individual to do this. It's not a group activity, spiritual realization. Though we are here in a group, and when there is a group, many times the meditations and the silences are more intense than when you meditate at home, and it gives you a sense of, okay, I know how I can, what this feels like, because there's a feeling about this. I just touched upon that briefly, but this morning, but this feeling of oneness is an actual experience. You have the feeling of the peace, the feeling of the presence of God. You can feel when you're in a deep sense of peace and no words and thoughts, that that peace that comes is a feeling that you experience. Now, what do you do with that experience? What do you do with that? Because it's individual consciousness. You've been made aware of this spiritual dimension of life in one of its infinite forms, one of its infinite manifestations. So what do you do with that? When you recognize that it is of the Spirit, then you've come into agreement. You have taken the conscious step to allow, to let this spiritual nature function in you. Because we do have that capacity. I don't know why anyone would want to shut off the Spirit, but many people do. Many people have grown up in some kind of a spiritual tradition, and they think it's a bunch of malarkey, and so they've just gone off and said, I don't believe it. And doesn't do anything to Spirit. It doesn't change the reality. Your belief does not change what is. You can believe the world is flat, and not want to get in a boat and go across the ocean because you're afraid you're going to fall off. That belief held Europe in bondage for hundreds and hundreds of years. And there are still as crazy beliefs. And people believe them so strongly that to them it is the truth. But it isn't. And it doesn't alter the truth. It doesn't alter what is. Now, this is coming in a very sacred manner. This I would never say to anyone outside of a class situation, because there are those that say, well, God told me to do this and God told me to do that, and they're very convinced and sure about what they have heard, and they go out and they shout it to the world. One of the mystical principles is that this is secret, and it's sacred because on the human level, this can be very misunderstood. There are websites that dish Joel's teachings that, because they say, oh, this man thinks he's God. This is, this is heresy. If there were religious people here, I wouldn't be able to voice what I'm saying, because it's heresy to orthodoxy. Because, and this goes back as far as Moses, it goes back as far as the original priesthood, when they told the people, you cannot say the word God, you can't spell it out. In Hebrew, there's only a symbol, and you can't say that word. Then they started putting in other words, Jehovah, Lord, because it was sacred. And if you said that word, and you knew the truth, you knew you were talking about this one self, this one I. But that can't be voiced to those who do not desire to know the truth. So the terminology here, individual consciousness, that takes this individual to bring spiritual awareness into the world. Without an individual, without a Jesus, there would be the Christ consciousness would not have come through in the way it came through. Maybe it has come through with many other individuals. But that particular form, that particular revelation, and the greatest gift that Jesus really gave mankind was the proof that even death, which is the greatest material power, is not a power in the presence of Christ consciousness. I can lay down this life and pick it up again. We all can do that if we had a clear enough understanding and realization of this presence. It's realization, knowingness. So I hope that, you know, Joel has always been my teacher. I'm really not here to contradict Joel, but at the same time, this idea, this mystical idea, and it's one idea that has many components to it that make up the whole, but this one idea is universal, and this one idea has been with mankind since the beginning, and it's been voiced and expressed over the millennium, and then it is veiled. And what veils this idea is the exposing it to the unprepared individual, exposing it to the materialistic thought, because the materialistic thought will discredit and there's no reason to voice it unless somebody is coming to you and they have seen something in you that they recognize as the truth. That's why classes are small. Joel used to have closed classes. He wouldn't let people in unless they had studied the work. He'd have open lectures and that were very general, and then he would go in and have the classes that were much more delving into the nature of mysticism and the nature of living out from mystical consciousness. See, so there's another term, mystical consciousness. But this is all one. That's the point. One consciousness. All my life, this is a question I have experienced, or something to comment on, that if I visualize what I want to materialize and send that intention out into the universe, if it is for my good, part of my harmony, then it does physically materialize. It has happened in my life many, many times. I have received material things that I have not had to pay for. I was a single mom without much money. Can you comment? Well, I think you've done very well. But visualization is a mental activity. You know that there's a book or in a movie you all probably are aware of called The Secret. And I touched upon it briefly this morning. The mind can be used as an instrument in this world. We talked about this mind-formed world. But this visualization, holding something in your mind and then having it appear, is, yeah, that's absolutely possible. It's been done many, many times, but it is not in the spiritual level. Now, why is this? Visualization is dependent upon your concept. You can only visualize something that you can conceive. Spirit is infinite. We can't conceive the infinite. When we go into the spirit without any desire, without any sense of wanting a particular thing, and we are just communing and being in that oneness, what unfolds in our life is coming out of the infinite, out of infinite consciousness, out of omniscience. What comes out of omniscience, all wisdom, and comes into our experience flowing through us, comes with no conditions. It's always going to be an activity of good. It's always going to be harmonious. And it is going to be a blessing not only personal for the individual, but it's going to be a blessing for all around. Now, that doesn't mean that that visualization is something bad. All it is that it's still on the material level. It's on this mind material level. And the more we experience the spiritual presence, this peace, this feeling, the greater our freedom is going to be, and the more abundant our life's experience is going to be. And that abundance is not necessarily going to come through traditional means. Doesn't mean you'll get a job as an investment banker. The abundance will come in many, many ways. And you can live like a millionaire without any money, because it's an attitude. You see the world with love. You see the abundance of nature. You see the harmony in individuals, and suddenly you find that you're living in abundance, in harmony with many, many friends. How does that come into one person's life? And another person can have millions and millions of dollars in the bank and be so lonely and miserable that they think of suicide. Nothing in this world has to do with your happiness. It might appear so at certain points in your life, but really your happiness, your bliss, is an activity of spirit. It's an activity of God. In our spiritual unfoldment, we do go through stages. In the mystery schools, in Masonry, Joel was a Mason. Masonry is patterned on the ancient mystery schools. And in those mystery schools, there are degrees and there are initiations to take you through each degree. And Masonry is secret. I mean, there's been so many books and stuff written on it that it's really not that secret, but that point of secrecy in Masonry or in all the mystery schools is to facilitate this individual experience with the divine, to facilitate our union, are realizing the light. In Masonry, the goal is always the question, always ask, what do you want? And the answer is always the light. What is it that you want? Illumination. What is it you desire? The presence of God. How do we get there? Well, this is the journey. And in the mystery schools, those who had the talent or the interest to get into the mystery schools were taught not only the nature of spiritual reality, how to see through the hypnotic appearance world that seems to have power, but they were also taught about the nature of the mind. So you have attached to the concepts of these mystery schools magic, you have the White Brotherhood, you have the Black Brotherhood, you have all of that, all those psychic kind of areas that the mainstream religions have wanted to discredit. Because what did it do? It challenged the power structure of mainstream religions, especially I'm talking in the Western tradition. So the church is more almost in unison, especially the early churches, wanted to eliminate this the individual's direct access to spirit. Why? Because it gave the individual power. Not personal power, but power in that they knew the secret of life. They didn't have to go through a priest to get to learn about what the secret of life was. The secret of life was there. So, and these mystery schools go back to the, well, in the Western tradition, the Western world, you can say, really started with the Egyptians. And the Egyptians were the ones that began the mystery schools. Now, I don't know how, you know, the Eastern traditions go back just as far, but I don't know that much about early Hinduism and what their evolution was from this single idea that was prevalent in all societies, that there is a spiritual dimension to life and man can experience that, and when he does experience that, he lives in freedom. That's a very simple premise. It's a very simple idea. And when you discover that spiritual dimension, you discover the truth, you live in freedom. But the being in the world and living in the world and putting this spiritual knowledge into practice, you go through these stages, and you go through initiations. Everybody goes through initiations. You might not know it's an initiation at the time. It could be a disease. You think, oh my God, you know, I've got some, you know, terminal disease, and all of a sudden you have never thought about spiritual things. All of a sudden the doctors say, well, you got 6 months to live. Make the best of it, and you think, well, maybe there's another way of living. And during those 6 months, you discover a spiritual practice, and in your discovery of the spiritual practice, that disease dissolves. Well, there's an initiation that's taken you from the gross material thought into a surety, a demonstrable a proof that matter has no power. Now, that is as great initiation as a crucifixion, because you actually have been crucified. You've been told you're going to die. And when you realize that death is not a power, that death is but a transition from one concept of life into, well, I won't say into another concept, but into another experience in life, you have this surety of it's not a belief and it's not a conviction, it's just a truth. So the stages that we go through begin with our introduction to spirit, the whatever draws us to the spiritual way of living. And it moves us out of, it starts moving us out of a belief structure, which is all that binds us to this world. And as these beliefs start to fall away, and we find that, gosh, I used to, how many times have you thought, gosh, you look back, I used to believe such and such. And that seems so odd that you would have ever believed that, because now it just looks very, very silly. So we evolve out of these beliefs, but with the beliefs comes the manifestation of the belief. And spiritually, error or belief cannot manifest itself. So we know that what we're going through is that we're pulling off layers of it like onion skins to see the truth. But to the degree that we believe something, we give it power, and that power seems to affect us. So every time that we go through a situation that seems to have power, and we have nullified that power, not by might, not through mental concentration, not through affirming or denying, but through this activity of Christ, this activity of the Christ consciousness, we are not only freeing ourselves, we are diminishing the power of that belief in humankind. So this grand outer mind, this conditioned mind that is impersonal, that is constantly around us, that we pick up all of these suggestions. Every time individually, one of these ideas that such and such has power is nullified. It not only frees you and you say, "Ah, why, how could I ever have been limited by that belief?" It also takes a notch out of the power of that belief worldwide. So this is the nature of world work. This is why the individual doing their work is not only affecting their own life, it's affecting all of human consciousness. It's what, when Jesus said, "If I be lifted up, I draw all men unto me." It was that if I can, and that's a very revealing statement. I mean, that's a very humble statement. If I can be lifted up, oh my gosh, can I free myself from all of the, because Jesus had just as many human conditions and belief, maybe even more so than we do today. If I can be lifted up, if I can get so empty, so free of this human concept of life, and experience that oneness with the Father, that oneness with infinite consciousness, I lift all men unto me. I break this bondage of material power. And so we go through these stages. In the first degree is where we become aware that there is a spiritual dimension. The first degree is where we learn the principles. It's where all the principles are presented. And many times when the principles are presented and you start feeling this presence, it's euphoric. You've never felt like this before. You feel this tremendous peace, and you want to maintain and be in that peace all the time. And sometimes that becomes almost a trap. You don't want to do anything else. You just want to be in that consciousness. So your whole life now is organized so that you can be in this consciousness. But as you become a little more, as you evolve a little more in this, you realize, well, you can never, that this consciousness has always been and always will be inseparable from your being. So you don't have to organize your life around certain ceremonies to be in this consciousness. That's this old way of thinking. Every time the truth was revealed, it was a ceremony, and somebody experienced this, then they wanted to make a ritual out of it, or a ceremony, or they personalized it, and this then veiled it. Then all of a sudden, rather than going into this infinite universal consciousness, oh, I have to go to Jesus, or I have to go to Buddha, or I have to go to someone else because they have the consciousness, and if I can attach myself to them or cling to them, then I'm going to get a ride on their consciousness. But don't you see that you have that same consciousness? And a good teacher is constantly telling the students, you've got it within yourself. And a good teacher will, yes, I'll help, definitely help you experience this spiritual dimension, but you've got it all within yourself. And you are free. And then you have these principles, you've learned these principles. They're in your mind. Not only in your mind, you know them. Like you know 2 + 2 = 4. You don't go around carrying that on a little piece of paper to remind yourself. You don't carry a book around reminding yourself that 2 + 2 = 4. You know it. When you know this truth, then you apply it to your daily life. Just as you use arithmetic every day. You don't think about it. You don't think about the multiplication tables. I would imagine that today with all our computers, most of us have forgotten the multiplication tables. But it's something that we know how to do. Therefore, we're not thinking about it. It's just part of our beingness. We do it. This is the next stage of our living out from the spiritual center. And it is this second degree where we begin to confront the problems that have been latent in our experience, beliefs that we don't even know that we accepted these beliefs until a problem comes and all of a sudden we are confronted with a challenge. Now, this is another form of an initiation. We have to put these principles into practice. And every time we witness the activity of grace in our life, we are reinforcing that activity in our experience. Now, we don't bring it to us because it's always there, but our bearing witness to the truth activates more truth in our experience, more of this spiritual way of living. And it's a growing circle. But the second degree is that degree where you are in the world but not of it. And in the mystery schools, it's the working degree. When you're the first degree, you're an apprentice. So you're learning the tools and you're learning the craft or the trade. Second degree, you're a journeyman. So you're out there building this consciousness. You're out there putting the brick and the mortar together and building the temple. And what is the temple that you're building? That temple that you're building is your awareness of truth. And that is built brick by brick. And every brick represents a nullification of a material limitation. Every time you realize that doesn't have power, you've put another brick in your temple. Until you have built this consciousness of truth to the point where you go into the third degree. And the initiation into the third degree, which is the master consciousness, Joel uses the master consciousness a lot because it's Christ consciousness. That degree requires a death. In the mystery schools, there is a symbolic death. You go through, I don't want to reveal any secrets, but I know you go through a symbolic death. And I know in the ancient Egyptian mystery schools, that symbolic death was actually a trial by death. If you survived that initiation, you really had overcome the fear and the sense of power of this material world. And the Hindu tradition, there's a great story. My mom put it down in a book called The Cave Story. And it's about this same thing. The masters were completely detached from the material sense of power. They could create images that people would believe. They could make those images disappear. Why? Because they knew that what people perceive is usually through their conditioning and through their mind, and that they're not perceiving life through their spiritual faculties. And in the story of a psychologist decides that he's going to say, well, the Western mind is more powerful than this Eastern mind. And he challenges this guru who has a cave where he presents these initiations. And it patterns the story of Buddha. It's almost exactly the same thing that Buddha went through when he sat under the Bodhi tree. The man goes into a cave and hears all of these negative appearances that he has to overcome. Snakes and tigers and all these horrible things. And it's easy. It's not easy, but the psychiatrist was knowing, this is an apparition. This is an appearance. This isn't real. I don't have to fight it. I don't have to pay attention to it because it isn't real. He comes in the cave to a point where there's a river in the cave. And to backtrack, the beginning of the story, this man has walked through this cave and witnessed that there's nothing in the cave. So when he goes in, you know, kind of under the spell of the master, and he's gone through all of these obviously negative things that are just apparitions, he sees this river, and he needs to get across the river to get out, but the river wasn't there. So how does he deal with that? And he sees a raft. Oh, I've been provided with a raft. So he gets on a raft to go across the river. Well, can you see the mistake that's just been made? The raft is just as illusory as the river. But it looks good, and it looks like it's going to facilitate his goal of getting out of this cave. But suddenly, he is now, at the beginning, he's being hypnotized. He's being hypnotized by these appearances. And then on the other side of the river, rather than finding the exit to the cave, he finds all these beautiful women, this banquet, this food, all this kind of stuff. Well, it's the same pattern that Buddha experienced under the Bodhi tree when he realized that all of the negativity of the world, the fear, the hatred, the conflict that was coming to him from the god Kali, the goddess, that came to him from her, he said, that has no power. And then all of a sudden, she sent her daughters, who were enticers, and they each represented one of the aspects of human pleasure, lust and pleasure, food and drink, and all those human goods. When Buddha saw that and said, you're exactly the same goddess, just in a different form. There still is no power to that. That's when illumination came. That's when he was free. So this psychiatrist going through the cave is already hypnotized to a little degree, thinking that this raft that took him across the river was provided to him by who? God? Where is there God in this cave? Is there any God in that cave? There's no God in that cave. We're not even talking about God. We're talking about mind. This universal mind and how this universal mind affects our perception of the world. And all of a sudden, there's this banquet and all this, and he feels very thirsty and he is hungry. And he says, well, what harm is it going to be to drink a little of the wine or have a little of the food? All of a sudden, he doesn't get out of the cave. Until there is something to wake him up that all of this is the illusion of the mind. All of this is our beliefs coming to us as appearances. Now, the mind can't form anything. It can't create anything. All it can do is take what already exists and cover it with its own concept. Give it its own qualities. So when it's told to us that we need to see through the appearance, what is it that we're seeing through? We're seeing through this mind concept of what constitutes our world. When we are in a forest and we look at a tree, and we look at the beauty of the forest, and the idea comes, well, God is the substance of all form. Is God in those trees? Is God in the grass and the flowers in the field? Is God even in the sky and the clouds? No. God is the spiritual essence, substance that underlies all creation. Is there a tree? Yes. We see the tree filtered through our material concepts. So the beauty that we see in a tree, we don't discount that. Oh, that's just the mind. That's a material concept. No, when it's beautiful, we know that it has that there's an element of spirit in it. Because God is all good. It's complete good. One good. One harmony. Beautiful. But we realize that we haven't seen the spirit except through our spiritual faculties. When these spiritual faculties are awakened, we have gone through a crucifixion. We have gone through the death. of climbing into the coffin, going through that cave, because the whole challenge in that cave story is that if you don't come out on the other side, you die in that cave. So maybe it's better to die in luxury, you know, with food and drink and women than to die by being eaten by a tiger. But you're still in the human world, and there still is that sense of death. When you come through that, when you're able to walk through the pleasures, the so-called goods of this world, without that human concept attached to the good, that we have this impersonal sense that says in the back of our mind there's only one good, spirit, one consciousness, spirit. Then we come and we are resurrected out of this belief structure of material sense. And this is the whole story of Jesus. But now, is this the end? Living in the resurrected consciousness? That is just the means to deal in this world from a spiritual standpoint. The true identity, the true being that we are, is the ascended consciousness. That has no attachment whatsoever to the material. Now, when Jesus was resurrected, part of the in that analogy of spiritual evolution, he showed the holes in his hands. He still had a physical body. Thomas put his finger in his side because he didn't believe it was really Jesus, and that, you know, we thought it was a ghost. So there is another step that we take, and that step is the ascension. Now, that ascension is not the death of our body. That really takes place in the crucifixion. You know, Paul said that you die daily to this world, and if you die daily, the first death has no sting. Is that what it is, or is it the second death? Because you've died once to this world, so when you reach that ascendant state of consciousness and you're moving out completely of any material limitations, that transition is in joy. That transition is with all the angel trumpets and with that great celebration that you are now experiencing the total oneness with divine consciousness without any material attachments whatsoever, not even the attachments of a resurrected body. Because even in that resurrected body, Jesus was dealing with human concepts, human opinion. I mean, doubt it, Thomas. I mean, do I have to prove that I am who I say I am? Do you want to put your hands in the holes of my hand? No, that whole state of consciousness that cannot accept the reality of truth is dissolved in the ascension. And we are in that ascended consciousness here and now. We have all experienced the ascension when we have been in that state of peace and that state of being where we are out of the body, where we are sitting, or sometimes it's moving, sometimes we are so one with our environment that this peace comes so strong that there isn't any separation. It's something I've experienced when sailing or when surfing, and I imagine that if people ski or even hiking in a forest or doing anything where you are so in the moment and so completely aware of your surroundings that in a sense all of your surroundings dissolve and disappear and you are one with your surroundings and you feel this great presence. Well, that's the ascension. You are no longer in that body. You are no longer in this world. You have stepped out of all the concepts of this world in that now moment. Now, you finish your run, or the wave goes away, and boom, you're back in the appearance world, but we're living in the world. Then it just shows you how we do not have to be of it. We do not have to accept any of the limitations of this world. They are not power. Joel, I'm sure, lived in the resurrected consciousness the last 2 years of his life. He knew, and when you listen to those lectures and those tapes and the messages that were presented during that time, they are the real mystical part of the Infinite Way message. Because he was so detached from this world that pure mysticism was flowing through. So that's a great gift. We should celebrate that gift. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow. Oh, we have a meditation tonight, don't we? What, a meditation at 6 o'clock, is that? At what time? At 5:30. Oh, can we make the meditation a little bit later? Do we have appointments or anything? Can we make it? Because I... 6, because my appointments... I've got an appointment at 5:30. Boy, these appointments, it's... So we'll come back and meditate at 6, and it will be about 20 minutes or so, just of a silent meditation. So if you are commuting and or anything, it will just give you a nice little silent send-off. Thank you.